Hello, everybody. This is the Brothers Wisp number 37. This is Thanksgiving weekend. What is it? November 26th, 2016. Today we've got a young, fresh chipper, Thomas Kernek, all the way from Slovakia.
Hello, hello.
We've got a remarkably back to life Tom Smith, all the way from Ireland. Say words, Tom. There you go. They have to hear your voice so they know who you are. Still, he doesn't want to say anything. All right, anyway.
Oh, then, sorry.
There he goes. And then we also have Mike Hammett, all the way from Chicagoland.
How's it going?
Excellent. So let's jump right in. There was the London mom, I guess another one of the mini moms, which Thomas is speculating is going to be the new norm. But Thomas actually had a booth there with Unimus, the fantastic backup software, right? Vendor agnostic, but was really designed. I guess one of your first products was MikroTik, right, to back those up?
Yeah, one of the first ones, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so give us a little bit of an overview. How'd you like it? How was it?
So, first of all, I was actually proven wrong because there was a two-day mom announced in Milan in March, and I got a confirmation that there will also be a two-day mom in US in April as well. So I guess they're trying to do a lot of the little one-day moms, but the big two-day moms are still there. And it was actually quite nice in London. Quite a few people, good crowd, good, you know, just a good, nice little mom.
Cool. Did you meet anybody that recognized your face from the thing, the stuff that we do?
Actually, a few people, yeah.
Oh, there you go. They tell you how good looking you are.
And thank you for everybody that came to, you know, say hi and that actually recognized me. I mean, that was great.
Yeah, you're a little minor celebrity in this tiny little circle.
far from.
All right. So there's a little bit of hardware news out of the MUM, right? The CCR 1009, they're doing a hardware upgrade on these things. Change them out so there's no switch chip and supposedly more throughput. Do you have any background on those? Any little bit more information?
Yeah, no switch chip. There is actually a combo port now. So you have an SFP / RJ45 port. And yeah, so hopefully there is more changes to the hardware under the hood, but who knows? Yeah.
Hopefully for the best. Let's see what else. There was a new Haplite with a new design / color, right? They're making them in black. I like the kind of shape a little bit better than the old style that had that sort of weird swoop at the bottom. I like them being more rectangular and square, kind of fit flat on a shelf. I think that's what I like about that. And then there was the WAP LTE. Anybody have more information on that?
So I actually looked at that quite a bit because I really like it. And what's interesting about it is that it's a normal WAP, right? So you have one Ethernet port, local wireless and everything. But the LTE antennas are actually all the way across the sides of the device, and they even go down to the little cutout that you actually take out to get to Ethernet ports. And it has an onboard SIM slot as well, so it looks like a really nice LTE termination device.
Gotcha.
Indoors, of course, but actually, is the VAP also outdoor? Does anybody know?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen too much about it other than just a little bit of pictures we saw.
I think it actually might be outdoors as well.
It was, though, I think, because it was originally, wasn't that the passive, the fiber, remember, the dumb fiber to copper converter before it became a WAP?
So, oh, yeah. So it was outdoors as well, yeah.
Yeah.
I just checked. So it seems like a really nice, really solid little device, and even I personally know that we are going to use it a lot. It's just much easier than, you know, plugging in the USB dongle 4G modem.
Yeah, and I guess traditionally MikroTik's been kind of hit or miss as far as driver support for different 4G devices, right, coming off the USB ports. So theoretically, if it's all their hardware design, it should be more stable.
Then also just that antenna that's in there is going to behave so much better than just a little integrated antenna in a USB modem.
Gotcha.
How do they compare with the Huawei, let's say, like the 315s? Like, we've had amazing experience with the Huawei 315s. Typically, because of the whole driver issues with LTE and all that with MikroTik, we just stayed away from it. We just use actual LTE to Ethernet routers, and I just use an Ethernet port on a MikroTik rather than actually go through the pain of the LTE driver suite, you know, that kind of way. So I was just wondering, have you experienced comparing that, the WAP, to the, let's say, more incumbent LTE client units?
We actually use quite a bit of LTE and 4G because basically in Slovakia we have a really sweet deal on LTE where you can get 50 gigs of 4G for €5 a month, and we actually deployed a ton of those. It's from a local small LTE only provider that really wants to be competitive, and they have coverage in all the major cities, not in the little cities and villages, but it's enough for us, and we've deployed a lot of those for backup connectivity, even you know, out of band management, and so far all of that has been with just directly 4G mode USB modems plugged into like 951s and 750s and stuff like that, so hexes and HAPS, and it worked great for us so far. We don't have any issues. But it's still two devices, and even with two devices in the sense that you have a MikroTik router and then a USB modem, and for you it's also two devices, right? Because you have the. So I don't have any personal experience with Huawei or any of the actual things because we haven't deployed them. But personally, I still think it's, you know, you are going to put a MikroTik there anyway, right? So having one device instead of two, having one. You know, one potential failure instead of two potential failures, and also all the security that goes with it, and management and monitoring and everything. So I am really looking forward to those little LTE VAPs.
Any idea on the street price of those guys?
No idea here.
Yeah, I was trying to do a little digging. I couldn't see anything anywhere.
Yeah, like for us, it was more that the routers were actually subsidized by the provider, and because we were using their provider devices, we got support. So it was like, while you do have the second router overhead management overhead, one of our principal reasons for going with it was that the provider was saying, here's a router, there you go, you should get connectivity, and that as long as we could prove that they were giving us connectivity with their device, we could push it on them. While if we had, let's say, a MikroTik or a custom LTE product that they didn't actually support, we were on our own, you know, that kind of way. So that was one of our... how easy or how difficult is the config on LTE on the MikroTiks for
so that? It depends if you are using direct IP or if you just use straight off PPP. For us, we've been using just PPP everywhere because, you know, you can actually get up to 15, 16 megs with just PPP connection. And for us, it's great because, you know, we have the second info channel, which gives you signal quality, all the data and statistics from the modem. You can pull that off from SNMP and graph and monitor and all of that. So... in that way, when you use actual PPP mode for 3G, 4G, it's a few commands, you know, set up PPP profile, set up PPP client, and you're done. And I haven't dealt with direct IP, so I don't know there. But it's
there's
not
no real LTE configuration at all. That's all just done by the chipset.
Yeah, by the modem, yeah.
Okay.
You just plug in the SIM card and create the PPP client, and bam.
Cool.
And, I was just looking, because I've done some LTE stuff, and so I was just doing some digging here, and it looks like starting in 6.37, they allow you to send and receive SMS over LTE as well.
You could have done that before as well, but not at the same time with the data connectivity. Now it's at the same time.
That's cool, getting support for it. All right, very cool, very cool. So moving on, who is it? Andrew Thrift's been very I guess, busy as far as looking at chipsets. He's always been. He's always looking at the underlying hardware of all these devices and kind of best of breed and all that stuff. And so lately he's been really on his soapbox about the Cavium chipsets. The Octeons, I think they're ARM-based processors. He's saying that he's really been pushing MikroTik to hopefully take a look at those guys. There's a lot of other vendors that have started using them. Supposedly support's really good from the manufacturer. I guess since they're ARM-based, there's going to be a lot easier to code for as opposed to the Tile platform. And I think, was it even, wasn't he saying that some of the EdgeMacs, some of the Ubiquiti routers are using these chipsets?
Yeah, no, the Cavium Octeons are used in the EdgeMacs routers from Ubiquiti. And the fact that they're actually used in the OpenBSD platform is a reflection of the chip vendors' attitude towards releasing firmware, releasing the information and the source code to integrate with the platform to use it properly. So no binary blobs, because that's a big no-no with OpenBSD. So if you give people the information and the access to the platform to actually properly utilize it, as opposed to trying to work around blobs and work around crazy kernel choices that some people have made in the past, I think that's a really positive thing. So yeah, the EdgeMacs, that's why OpenBSD supports the EdgeMacs routers, or the Cavium Octeon. Now they're, interestingly enough, they're MIPS-based processors, while the new generation ones that Andrew Thrift is all excited about is an ARM-based. It's actually a tile architecture in ways, but it's ARM, it's an ARM-based as opposed to MIPS, which would have been, let's say, the original Cavium Octeon ones that the original EdgeMacs routers from Ubiquiti used. So there's actually been a generation change, but it seems to me that the methodology or the approach of the chip manufacturer Cavium is being very open with the developers and very open with the community that will use it to create these products. So that's a positive thing, and I think anyone who uses it will have a significant competitive advantage over chip manufacturers that bluntly shoehorn people into certain kernel versions that are totally unsuitable for the role that they're trying to make. No comments. Additional comments needed. No think on that one.
I think that was a comment.
Yeah, I was going to say, no additional comments, or where are you going with that?
I don't have a mic to drop.
All right, good deal. All right, so moving on right down the list. EdgeMax SFP Plus support has been announced, and I guess they had supposedly had hinted around it before, but they've officially said in the was it in a change request log, something like that. Was it Chris over at Ubiquiti? Is that his name?
I think that was his name. I didn't realize he worked at Ubiquiti until I actually put two and two together. I saw him commenting on Facebook on one of the groups, and then I. Like, hey, wait a minute, it's Chris, whatever his name was on Facebook. That kind of matches up with the initials of the on the Ubiquiti forum.
Yeah,
the guy that was posting.
There you go. So you got a celebrity posting on your Facebook there, Mike. So it looks like they're going to be adding some 10 gig interfaces to the EdgeMax line, which is competition, right?
While MikroTik still holds the lead over the EdgeMax platform as a whole, there are a few areas that EdgeMax is winning, and see what they do with this new platform.
That'll be interesting.
Well, what do you mean, Mike? I think there's been a fair few compromises made in trying to make the CCRs work in terms of stability. What are the EdgeMaxes not doing that MikroTik is doing that you think that Ubiquiti are behind at this stage?
Well,
honestly, that list would be really long.
It is fairly extensive, but, in 10 gig ports is one. Mac Telnet is another. Winbox is another. They do have some MPLS features. They've been adding more They don't. I don't believe they have VPLS yet. I'm sure there's a lot more that we could go into. But then on the other side,
even just the wonderful scripting language that Microtik has, where you can do so many things, which you know you cannot simply do on the edge routers, and all the monitoring and management related things, Dromon and proxying of management connectivities, and just quality of life things.
But there's also like stability issues, like tunnels being completely unstable for the last maybe 10 releases of Microtik. Like we're having actually a nightmare in our use of Microtik, and just simple LTTP or SSTP tunnels, just the stability isn't there. And I do think it's a serious issue. I think in terms of MPLS support, I think there's massive gaps in Microtik's MPLS support, and there's massive gaps in their support for the Microtik for their actual product support, in terms that if you have multiple paths to a location, that the failover doesn't work properly if you're using OSPF signaled routes, you know. So if you're actually signaling with RSVP and traffic engineering, just that, you know, if you have two paths to a certain location, you can't bring up the second path, and you know, you're not getting answers on this, and we're not the only ones who have seen these problems. And
oh, look at it this way, yes, at least you have RSVPTE.
Yeah, but there's...
I mean, as compared to edge router, right?
Okay, but the point I'm trying to make is that you've... it's not enough, and this is something, like, fair enough, it's very cost-effective, but it's not enough to just say we support it badly. You know, no support is better than bad support, in my opinion, because you actually go about and embark on a project, you time and expense... And then suddenly the product doesn't work, and they say it won't work till version 7, or 8, or 9, or 10, based on previous performance. What are you to do? You know, like, I mean, bluntly, like, you know, if you're going to support something, do it right, and don't have all these bugs, and at least give the people who support your products the right answers and the right support for it. I think that's like not too much to ask, and maybe. And I was just wondering about your experience on edge routers, that on the stuff that they do support, do they actually work?
So the last time I personally used edge routers was about a year and a half ago, and there were also issues which might have been resolved at this time. So I really cannot offer a recent comment on that. I don't know if somebody else can.
It's been a couple of years for me since I've used them in production. I did, I can't speak to stability, but I know as far as the GUI goes, they seem to lag behind more so than Microtik. So when I introduce a feature, it takes them a lot longer to actually get it into the GUI as opposed to Microtik. Usually it's introduced in Microtik in X version, and the very next version it's available in Winbox for configuration. Not always, but it seems like usually it's in there pretty quick. Stability-wise, I can't say one way or the other. It's been so long since I've actually used them.
Well, I mean, personally for us, we've been running a fully Microtik network for years now, and I'm not saying it's all peachy and everything works, but we haven't had any deal-breaking stability issues here, so you know, your experience may vary.
Yeah, and I know other people have run into some showstoppers in the MPLS realm. You know, MPLS, VPLS, I think, as Tom alluded to, whenever you have backup routes, and then I think if you fail over to those backup routes, and then when the original route, the more stable, the more preferred one, comes back online, it doesn't automatically switch back. Things like that, right, that are pretty significant, and the only thing that fixes is a reboot. But I think those are, I'm not going to say fringe cases. I'm just looking at your average WISP, and most of them aren't doing MPLS, VPLS, right? So that's something that's not going to bite them. It's just going to be the more advanced infrastructures like yours or MSPs or things like that. And not to say that's okay to have a bug and say, I mean, I don't know. I think it's okay to have a bug. It's okay to say we're fixing it. I think some expectation of timeline is really nice for anybody, right? You don't want to be sitting there waiting and guessing.
Like for us, it's like our whole ISP was built on it. And, you know, you spend 10 years of your life actually putting it into it and trying to shape the development or try and shape the, you know, the course of it and try and embrace it and, you know, train other people on it and support those other people on it and support them with the ambitions. Like the amount of, I just find it frustrating when people say this works really well when it doesn't work as well as they say it. And then when you actually, you know, you go and you look for the assistance, it's not really there, or the sincerity in the backup isn't there. That's, you know, that is something that needs addressing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like the route filter bugs and things like that, a sincere expectation of what the roadmap for completion of version 7, you know, to me, it's acceptable to say, you know what, we realize there's issues with that. We're going to fix it in version 7. I'm okay with that. Just tell me when version 7 is coming out. Show me an expected roadmap and the steps you're going to take to get there, right? So I can plan accordingly. Do I need to redo this portion of my infrastructure because time-wise it's not going to come out soon enough, right? Help me set expectations a little bit better. I see that as being something that would be extremely helpful.
Like, route filters is one of those things that it's been such a serious bug for such a long time, and it indicates either something seriously wrong with the compilers that they're using, or the code that they're using, or the code practices, or the blended code that they're using, or the layered, the libraries that they're using, that they can't, what I can't understand is that they can't audit it and actually see, because in some cases, the root filter bugs are hideously scary. And I mean, like, it's a bit me in the ass, it's a bit my customers in the ass. And, you know, they've been around for quite some time, you know?
Yeah. So I guess anybody listening to us talk about the route filter, if you ever have a route filter not function properly, I've noticed if you, like one of your lines isn't working, if you grab it and you drop it down in the list, then you move it back up. Sometimes that will kick it back into gear, or if you just delete that line and then re-add it back, that usually will kind of kick it back in. Any other little tricks you use, Tom?
Yeah, like if you're afraid of, let's say, root leaks in deleting and adding, what we do is we copy the rule set in, take a note of the, before you copy it, what's the last rule? Copy the new rule set in, which is exactly the same as the old rule set, and then delete the original rule set, you know, to reduce the risk of, let's say, a leak, you know, if you have a deny rule and you're about to delete it. But, you know, but it then forces to, that type of approach then also forces inconvenience, like drop appears, you know, so soft resets aren't quite as soft or as useful as you'd like, and that you often have to do a hard reset of your BGP peers and stuff like that. But that's the way we're living with it at the minute. Recursive next hop lookup in version 6 not working is kind of unusual, I suppose, and a big barrier to people going IPv6 on BGP. So that's another issue that they need to deal with. You know, there's just a few things that router OS not routing things, you know, that are, you know, that they need to deal with, you know. And like if you look at the LCTP while they're adding all the LNS and all that type of stuff, but they break LCTP stability. And this is more insidious cases where it's working, you know, it works fine for a couple of weeks. And then if there's intermediate problems with your providers, you know, packets dropped, packets out of order, we're not too sure, and then suddenly, you know, the tunnel is locked up, tunnel won't reestablish, but if you reboot one or both sides, it starts to work again. It's that, you know, intolerance of kind of real world scenarios that The reality is that a lot of our time at the moment now is backfilling on bugs that our vendors are giving us, and that's actually taking up a significant portion of support time and engineering time. Where, you know, like there was a site, you know, like I've been doing LCTP tunnels for 11 years with Microtech, you know, it's fairly straightforward. It's not rocket science. You're on a site and you set it up like the way you normally do, and it suddenly just won't establish for whatever reason on the newer branches that are current. It's just quite frustrating. Not to mention, of course, the stateful packet filter rule drop from everyone's firewall rules, which was disappointing, really.
Yeah, and so Tom is referring to a quick bug that was in, if you were running, I think, 6 previous to 6.22 and earlier, and you upgraded to 6.37.0 or 6.37.1, it would remove any established or related commands you happen to have in the firewall at the time. So your accept all established related at the top of your firewall list all of a sudden became accept all, which was unfortunate. What were you about to say, Thomas, before I interrupted you?
I mean, I think it's pretty easy to focus on the negative things which you can find in any vendor. Mm-hmm. I mean, just recently I purchased a HP 1500 chassis, and this is, you know, I bought it secondhand, so it was kind of cheap. But if you bought that thing new, it wouldn't be cheap at all, right? So it's actually a fairly big boy switch / router, right? And this is HP. This is, you know, Procure Provision OS. So this has been around for years, and you would be surprised how many bugs even they have. And actually, they have conflicting documentation within pages inside of the manual. And there is 5 ways to do things, and I could, you know, I could complain a lot. And I mean, this is HP Procurve, like I said. This is professional database grade series chassis switches, right? So I think it's really easy to focus on the negative at any vendor, because you will find it, right? I mean, come on, guys, Mimosa and Ethernet issues, right? Like, you can find these issues in any vendor.
Oh, absolutely,
vendor, right? And it's extremely easy to focus on the negative. And I mean, every single vendor, whatever vendor you look at, and don't even get me started on Cisco, right? They all have bugs. They all have issues.
Oh, no, it's not the bugs. It's the attitude to the bugs, the follow-up, the support, the response.
I wish you good luck trying to get, you know, any response and follow-up to bugs in HP Procurve, right? How would you even go about that? And how much money would you have to spend on all the appropriate services? I mean, every single vendor is different. We could debate for hours how one vendor is better or worse than other in some ways, but every single vendor will have just something that will irritate you.
I think
it's the inevitability of IT.
It's the one universal.
Yeah.
But true, right? And I think what's interesting is, as passionate as people get about this, I think it just shows how much they trust and rely on the product. And I use it every day, and I use it in so many different facets, and it's saved my ass so many times. I think if MacGyver was a network engineer, he would, instead of carrying a Swiss Army knife, he'd carry a Microtik, you know? Because they can kind of do anything. And I think the level of discomfort that people show for Microtik just shows you how passionate they are about the product and how much they actually depend on it, right? And so I think people getting upset about it, I don't always see it as a bad thing, right? It just shows that they really like this product and they really care about it. And
it's a great product. It could be even better. The frustrating part is that they have something working, and in order to improve packet forwarding performance on a particular architecture, they seem to break the stability of it. And that, like for me, if it works day one, you know, when you configure it, and then you have to reboot it to get it back working again, that it's intolerant of external stimuli or external interference. It just adds a load onto, and you know, this wasn't always there. Do you know what I mean, Tom? So, like, what I'm trying to say is that it's all good and all that, but just I'd rather like a really ultra stable branch. Like, probably, maybe I'm wrong on this, but maybe 5.27 and 5.28 for any bug fixes for, you know, and...
Oh, no, I couldn't live with 5 anymore. Oh, no.
Or, but you see, but here's the thing, like, you know, when there was big issues with, you know, there's issues with different versions, but we're always promised a better version along the line, but just, I suppose we've been burnt so many times with different bugs that, like, and it's not something we're doing wrong. Like, and I remember, like, asking lads, maybe we need to, you know, we're discussing this internally in our team, you know, we're kind of saying, and I'm going, maybe we're doing something wrong. Maybe we need to refocus, re-look at it. And the guys went, when was the last time support from Microtech came back to you and said, you stupid idiot, you didn't do this, or you didn't do this, try this? It's not that. It's like, we'll look into it, we'll do this. It's not like a case where you're actually getting, this is what you did wrong, Tom. That's why it's not working. You know, that kind of way. And it's just as frustrating, you know. That's, you know, because it is the way it's stopping our development. Yes, and that's, and I think, you know, we all make mistakes. Lord knows I've made mistakes. But we need to learn and acknowledge our mistakes to get better from it afterwards. And from some of the conversations I've had with the guys, I think sometimes they acknowledge it, but then more times, I think the roof filters issues going on for as long as were the MPLS issues. There's no known issues log. The fact that there's no known issues log is the indictment of someone's attitude in that organization to let people know what problems they have so that they don't have to learn it for themselves. So all that time and effort, human time and effort wasted because someone won't admit that they have problems on their system. It's frustrating.
You feel better? Is that cathartic?
Pardon?
So was that cathartic? Do you feel like you've exorcised the demons?
I think I've just shared the pain a bit.
No,
problem shared is problem halved. I'm not too sure. I want to see it do better, but in order for them to do better, when they're, it's like the Irish team playing Australia today. We bet them and we were delighted, but we lost basically a third of our team. Loads of backs were basically a third of our team were playing out of position because we had so many injuries of key players.
And you could see they were all on the bar.
Anyway,
wait, are we talking about sport?
Yeah, no.
What is that?
There was a period in the game where they were playing really badly, and that's my analogy here, is that I feel my team that I support and love are playing badly, and that they have some gaps out wide, defensive gaps that they just need to plug, that they need to put resources in to focus on, care about, understand that this causes a lot of pain for people. Deploy resources and make the problems go away. So that the next time we're on, we're thinking, Jesus, you know, they made that problem go away. We're really happy with them.
All right, so while we're on really the subject, let's put one last word into it. If there was a single thing, one single thing they could do that would make you feel better about everything, if they could put some salve on your wounds, what would it be? What would that one thing be, Tom?
An honest, no BS, no issues log.
All right, so if they said, these are the known issues we have, this is a timeline that we're going to fix them, this is just what we know is wrong.
No, because then what will happen is they'll look at it and go, we really need to do something about that one, and that one, and that one, and that one. And suddenly some minor features go away. One other point I would like to say about Ubiquity versus the Microtech thing, apart from, is that taking time to bring something from command line to a GUI is not necessarily a bad thing if it's well thought out. I'm not going to say any more than that. But I think you understand what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I'm rushing to put a...
Yes. I love it, Tom.
Rushing to put a GUI around a command line doesn't often end up in wonderful results for usability.
I think for a newcomer, it's probably cumbersome to try and figure everything out. But if you're accustomed to all of these things and they just add one new thing at a time, it's probably a little bit easier for us to piecemeal, right? I think that's probably a problem for us, right? We don't have fresh eyes. We're too close to it. So we've been using it for so long, we don't really know what a newcomer's perspective is anymore. I don't think we can adequately, I don't think we can fairly say what it's like for a new guy to jump in and use this stuff. So
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like a newcomer with the results we get sometimes. Okay. No, but like cognitive friction, that type of stuff. No disabled equals no, enabled equals yes, that type of stuff. There's coding standards that Tom will probably know a lot more. I'm just starting to get back into consistency of configuration language. And that's just even on the command line. But then the view, like I remember for a long time, it has changed, you know, the IPsec configuration of, you know, the client versus the server was actually looked different. I was kind of going, well, why would you make what is essentially a negotiation between two parties that have to have identical configuration? Why would you make the actual configuration of them look different to what they actually are? This was just a thing that wrecked my head. I was like, this should be simple because now I have to train this interface and I have to train that interface. They have changed that, and I thank you for listening to me on that. Or maybe Thomas or Greg or Mike said it. But I'm glad you did that because that makes sense when the original. And these are the things that we're trying to prove with them. And I just feel that sometimes they're not listed.
Yeah. And then to that end, if you don't contact a manufacturer, and I think Mike put this up, and tell them that you have a problem with their product and what the specific problem is, how are they going to know it's a problem? So if you do have issues, if you do run into something, be sure to send it to support with a nice smiley face at the end. Don't be rude. Don't use words that are inappropriate because maybe those things get flagged and dumped in the trash.
That can happen. Trust me. And in their defense, the IPsec interface where they actually did amalgamate or make them identical, that's an example where they listened. And I think it was a massive positive impact on our ability to train customers as a result, you know. So
I'm sure there's been multiple instances where they've listened. I know I've done bug submissions where they acknowledged and then fixed it pretty quick. So it happens. It happens to everybody. So,
and in fairness, they turned the bug around. They did turn the bug on the connection tracking issue, that was actually turned around really quickly.
Yeah, so 637.2 fixes the problem. So as long as you're using the most recent.
And if you've implemented 6.37 or actually a recent one after, but before, as in going from below 6.22 to above 6.3 something, let's just say that, because I'm not too sure when that bug was introduced. Check your firewall rules. Just make sure they haven't been neutered by the addy except rules. Okay. That's best practice. You know, that's the thing, you know. Okay. Thanks very much. Sorry.
So let's move on.
I mean, honestly, if people had proper change management processes and test it in the lab before they deploy into production, you know how many things would just work much better than they do. So things like this should be detected and should not happen in production due to proper change management. So nobody should ever have issues like this, right?
Well, yeah, true. To some degree, I think most labs...
That was a joke, of course.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good deal. To that end, most labs don't have legitimate traffic moving through, so it's really tough to... Right? You can put stuff in a lab all day, but until you're moving real stuff through it, you don't always...
things like firewall rules getting disabled from version to version, why, yes, that's a horrible bug. You know, your change management process should definitely flag that.
Yeah.
Or Unibus would have flagged it in fairness, actually.
It would have as well, yes.
Yeah, so like you'd go, well, what's the difference? But I suppose you just, it's reasonable to assume that wouldn't happen. But anyway, look, but in fairness, they changed it, they acknowledged it, they moved on, and that's a really good thing. And we want to see more.
That's a good thing.
That's what I want to see. I want to see less new features, more stability on the older features. Thank you.
All right, let's move on. We beat that dead horse and backed over it and then lit it afire. Something else, even with the hardware stuff, somebody clued us in that Juniper is getting extremely aggressive on pricing. I think they said that we're not going to lose this project on price, so just tell us how cheap we need to be. So now would probably be a good time to reach out to your vendor if you're interested in doing so on some of the Juniper kit. I can't remember why they said that. Do you remember what the rationale was on why Juniper was so cheap at the time?
I think they lost a major client.
Was it Ericsson or something like that?
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
And so they're just trying to fill that void.
Yeah. So if you are interested in Juniper, which I'm a Cisco guy, so that's like it's Greek to me, but they make good kit. A lot of the ISPs I end up bumping into use the Juniper stuff as well, so it's got to be solid, right?
And they never have bugs, ever.
No. Couldn't happen, couldn't happen. Something else I think that hit the media was that SpaceX is launching a bunch of little satellites. They're not geosynchronous, right? So geosynchronous would be it follows your exact position in orbit, right? So that same satellite's always over you. Kind of like satellite TV, right? You always point the exact same satellite. But these are going to be lower orbit satellites, I believe, right in there. Touting some pretty good speeds, and I guess the latency isn't going to be 600 milliseconds. Anybody have any additional information on those?
Ambitious.
Ambitious.
Yeah. I love it. It's just Musk at his best. I just love it. So currently, actually, there are about 6,000 satellites in orbit altogether. And SpaceX's plan is to deploy 5,000 almost just for this single project.
Jesus, that's insane.
And yeah, non-geosynchronous satellites, they are promising up to gigabit speeds at 35 seconds latency. And the CPEs are going to be extremely advanced phased array multi-antenna CPEs, which should go about $200 from their initial pricing guesstimates. And they actually submitted all of the paperwork to FCC. I've read through it. It's amazing technology. And yeah, I love it. I really wish this would happen.
Is it going to put WISPs out of business, I guess?
Well, it's going to be a global competitor for WISPs, and even for us, but and even for all of us that you know are here and are listening to this, I would say. And that's, of course, from a certain point of view, a bad thing. But from another point of view, if I think about all the people that just have no way of getting decent internet access, and even in my other projects outside of our WISP, so many times we've had issues with getting decent connectivity at decent price, and this is, I think it will really help. Not, you know, it might upset us, it might steal some customers from us, but on a global scale, this is a great project, I think.
Yeah, consistent 35 milliseconds of latency with gigabit speeds, that's pretty unbeatable.
I really like the joke that Musk made that, you know, China is probably going to start shooting down the satellites because there is no way to actually enforce the great firewall of China over those connections, and theoretically anyone can get connectivity from a satellite. So, you know, it's so many levels that things like this have.
Interesting. That's a lot of low orbit satellites. It seems that's going to be a pretty big hurdle to get the government to allow them to shoot that much into space, right?
Well, you know, just another potential worldwide conflict coming.
I was listening to an NPR podcast, I think it was 99% Invisible, but they were talking about all the space junk, right, and just the microstructure, you know, just the tiniest particles in space, you know, they start accelerating faster and faster, and then they start pinging holes and stuff up there. So if you launch 5,000 more satellites, it's just going to be an even higher likelihood that stuff's going to just turn into junk and then bash into each other.
Honestly, most of that stuff actually falls off. Like, for example, at the orbits that SpaceX is talking about, which is from 800 to 1,000 miles, you know, you actually need to maintain that altitude. It's not, you know, you just put something up there and it stays there. You know, gravity does its work. So even if the satellite breaks down, you know, the junk won't stay in orbit.
It's going to pull down.
Yeah.
It's going to fall on my house and kill me. Or I'm assuming like, it'll burn up.
If you're above orbital velocity, it'll just keep going further and further away. If you're below, it'll eventually dip in and reburn. And then if you're at orbital velocity, then that's a different story. Like, but yeah, like it is an interesting concept. But also because they're only that close to the, because China did, remember they launched a missile to knock one of their satellites that were disabled out of orbit. And then the Americans said, we can do that too, but a month later with just a kinetic weapon. So they just used the speed and the weight of it to hit the satellite, the old disabled US one, just to prove China that we can do that too. So don't be getting any ideas about knocking GPS satellites out of orbit or anything like that. Mm. But I think that was back in, 2008? I think it was mid-2008. When China knocked one of their own, so that was probably at geostationary, which is around 30,000 kilometers. So,
actually, GPS satellites are not geostationary.
Are they not? No. Well, no, I'm not talking about the GPS, but they knocked one of their own satellites out of orbit, like a disabled one. So I don't
like
know.
Actually, getting to geostationary orbit requires some serious power, serious fuel, serious rockets. So. I don't think like an attack missile that would be for geostationary orbit, that would be... Anyway, we are getting way off topic.
Still, it's fun though.
People like things that blow up, so...
All right.
Well, now, technically the US one was just a kinetic thing. It was just like bumped into it and then knocked it out.
We used the force, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the MV squared, is it?
All right, so moving right along, there was some interesting stuff. This was actually on the 2nd, I think, the news link came out on this one. AT&T poll lawsuits. I can't remember where this was. This Kentucky?
I believe they're having problems. They're fighting over Louisville.
Yeah, it's Google Fiber trying to get poles, right?
I guess this one was, well, we got some in Kentucky, and you got some issues in Nashville as well.
Yeah. So Google's trying to get on polls, and AT&T and Comcast are doing absolutely everything they possibly can to fight that, right, for obvious reasons. They don't want any competition in their areas. And so I think the FCC is actually kind of helping out Google in some form or fashion, right?
Yet the current process for when you do a poll attachment, well, once you have all the agreements in place to allow you to do them, then you put forth your plan to whatever company, and you know, you get back information on the number of polls and the number of polls that require make ready. Make ready is the process where they have to move things to permit you to use the pole or to replace the pole if it's not structurally sufficient to support what's on it and new load. And that can be extremely expensive. I've heard of over $100,000 to replace one pole that was just extremely loaded with stuff.
That's crazy. Yeah. And I think on top of that, those delay tactics have really, to put into perspective, the guy Chris from Google Fiber, here's a quote from him. He says, of the 88,000 poles we need to attach Google Fiber to throughout Nashville, over 44,000 will require make-ready work. He said, so far, only 33 total poles have been made ready. So they're not even close.
Yeah, and so what they're trying to do is get this one-touch make-ready where instead of each company going through and moving their own lines one at a time, there's a single company out of an approved list of vendors that moves everybody's stuff. So that way there's just one visit to their to the pole and it's done. And then, you know, a bunch of regulations about, you know, timelines for responses and things like that. And you know, obviously, you know, AT&T and Comcast aren't up for that, and Google is, because they do primarily aerial. So,
true story. So while Mike's talking, I've got a note on here that says Mike wants SNMP DOM / DDM support for SFPs. What's the story on that, kid?
So I discovered that something that I thought was fairly universal is not. When you have SFPs in your devices, you can typically go into your device's configuration, and you can retrieve information from the SFP, such as how strong of light it's putting out, how strong of light it's receiving, temperatures, different metrics that it can report, you know, in your CLI. Apparently, very few manufacturers, and they're not even consistent within a given manufacturer, provide that information over SNMP. It's like, why would that information not be available? Why would you, like, how can one monitor this reliably through the monitoring protocols that they support, SNMP? You know, you want to monitor your light levels to know, oh, if something changed, was it a gradual change over time? Was it a sudden change?
You're always so needy, Mike. First, you're dogging everybody to get SFPs, and now you want to be able to monitor them? What the hell?
I am personally just so happy it's somebody else that's complaining about things missing in SNMP than me. You know, I've been riding that train for years now, and finally it's somebody else who wants things in monitoring and SNMP.
Yeah, the Thomas Express. That's what we've named it.
But it's not like, you know, we're dogging Ubiquiti or Microtik or whatever. It's like Brocade. My Brocade switches don't have it. My Cisco switches, some do, not. Why, and it's not even like, you know, iOS versus iOS XR versus, no, like different iOS versions don't support it. Why? Why is there not consistency? In one of the Wisp lists, I brought it up, and a couple other people just assumed it was always there, and then they looked, and sure enough, they had stuff that didn't support it, and it's just shocking that something as critical as, you know, SFP temperature and light levels is not available for monitoring.
How fun. So let's switch gears completely. And going on a sort of a similar thread that Thomas had last time we talked, was that number 36? Thomas had a major outage in Slovakia, just kind of the internet as a whole, due to a fiber cut. And now it looks like there was a Google outage out in Middle Europe, kind of in maybe some of the Eastern U.S. How did that manifest, Thomas? Do you ever get get a little bit more information on that?
So it started, I don't remember the date anymore, but I think it started about 6 p.m. And, you know, originally it was actually just Slovakia and Czech Republic that were cut off from Google services. And as you can imagine, if Google goes down, a lot of stuff goes down. And what's even worse, of course, that many people use 8888 and 8844. And even that was down. So that was a whole lot of fun, and a lot of things just didn't work. And for a lot of people, the internet itself didn't work because of the reliance on Google's DNS. And so, yeah, it started in Slovakia and Czech Republic. Then it actually spread across most of Middle Europe, and then actually there were some outages in East Coast US as well. And the total outage of all Google services for us was about 6 hours.
That's crazy. Any idea what actually happened?
I don't know. And I haven't seen any like incident reports or outage reports anywhere yet. So maybe somebody can actually find something.
Interesting. Interesting in a horrible kind of way. All right. So let's see. Yeah. Tom, you did some Eidhnog. I'm guessing that's Irish nog.
Yeah.
Irish eggnog.
So it's in this SIG company.
Is that something similar to eggnog?
totally different. There is significant high elevations in alcohol content towards the end of it, but I suppose. But no, it's actually a dry event for the meeting itself, but then it gets very wet afterwards, I suppose. But it's very good, I have to say. So it was in SIG, they graciously hosted it, and they do like high frequency trading and market analytics and stuff like that. So they have the engineering team responsible for supporting the trading platform entertained us. And so, yeah, there was about 100 people at it, and they were just talking about IPv6. So they had Orla McGann from HEANet, which is basically our NRED, our basically research network. It's kind of academic and scientific research network in Ireland. They were talking about how they did IPv6 like 15 years ago, 16, 17 years ago. How they were just kind of, you know, they were on 6-bone, and then they got their proper allocation and all of that. And then how dealing with Ethernet interface cards that had no idea of IPv6 and were trying to do IPv4 header checksums on IPv6 packets and failing miserably and having to get kernel developers from Red Hat involved and all this. So it was actually really interesting, just all the pain that they went through, so that when we go IPv6 on our own network, that it's going to be very straightforward and simple. Yeah, so it was really cool. So they had different people describing how they use IPv6. Then they had Natalie from the training center from Rype. So the Rype, for the guys in America, you should be jealous because we're a member of Rype. You're a member of another Arrear. But basically, Rype are very proactive on training and outreach and research and development. They're pretty cool that way. And pardon?
Some would say that you need it more than we do.
Ha ha!
We did invent all this stuff, right?
But in fairness, like, yes, perhaps we do. Or perhaps we're receptive to trading. Like, we did try to train you all to vote Clinton, and that failed miserably. Moving swiftly on, as we congratulations, Donald Trump.
No, something tangential to IPv6. I was thinking about the other day. You know, if say you are a new network operator in the U.S. and you have to try and get some IP space, you're not going to be able to get IPv4, right? If you want to go into an exchange or anything like that, it's just. I mean, you can go to a broker and buy it, I suppose. But I don't think Aaron's really got much to hand out, correct? Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's where, let's say, Rype actually came up with the policy that any newcomer to the market will get 1,000 addresses. That's it. And that'll reduce further as time goes on. Okay. But that was the difference.
But say for example, you can't get that V4 allocation, right? And so V6 is your only option here in the States. I mean, I guess most of your major content providers, like your Netflix, your Google, your Facebook, you're going to be able to get to those on the native V6 network. But everything else, right? If you want to get to this website, this amazing The Brothers Wisp, that's only available on V4 right now.
For now. But you're right. Like, and actually, what they were saying was that the amount of networks in Europe, because of IPv4 shortage and possibly assets, selling IPv4 or moving, you know, retasking IPv4 to say, well, look, we'll just give them IPv6, do transition technologies. And that a lot of banks in Europe actually started going, actually, we're not getting the user telemetry. We don't have all the security features we want. And that there was, let's say, 30 or 40% of the users able to access them over IPv6, including, let's say, LTE, which would be, let's say, more like the 4G networks and the 3G networks did actually embrace IPv6 a lot more. And they embraced IPv4 that heavily. Like, if you ever look at your phone, the IP you get from your carrier, it's usually like a 10 address on the IPv4 stack. So basically they were just talking about how banks were and content providers wanted to get more telemetry on what users. And of course you lose all that if you're going through like you lose all that for your IPv6 customer base because they'd be going through a 6-4 transition or translation technology. And so they were saying that that's actually driving a move to IPv6 at the minute. And then, like Natalie was talking about at the IDOC, was basically talking about how 462 layers were announced at IPv6 and then suddenly stopped. And then they were like, then she was just describing how a lot of them were like, no, we should still be doing this. And then, you know, she checked back a couple hours, like, oh, it's all working now. But so, like, there was a few that just didn't know that they were dropping it. And okay. There was a few lads that didn't even know they were announcing it in the first place. Possibly some IPv6 guy was really enthusiastic, didn't ask anyone, announced it, and then left. And someone said, what's that config, and removed it. But anyway, but it was quite interesting. But then when the open discussion, it was actually Ed Morley from the IPv6 task force went on WebEx with us from the San Francisco Bay Area, and he was actually pretty cool. Like, he's working with Groupware, and he was just talking about all the various different adoption issues of IPv6, and that a lot of people go dual stack. I think one of the core things he was saying was, if you go dual stack with everything, including your monitoring system, suddenly you don't actually, when there's a problem, you don't know which stack you're having the problem on. And he was saying that it's useful to have pure IPv4 and pure IPv6 single stack monitoring, so that on a couple of devices, so that you can understand. As he was saying, and it was kind of funny, like the discussion, he goes, like, how many of my customers have said to me, I'm going to drop IPv6 traffic just for a second to see if that fixes the problem. And he goes, why don't you drop the IPv4 traffic? Maybe that's the issue. And, like, no one wants to do that. But he's saying, you know, he's saying, but why are people thinking, let's drop IPv6 like it doesn't matter? He says it's just as production as IPv4. So it was kind of really insightful evening, I have to say. And then there was a few free beers provided by Sync, which was very generous. So we, you know, I got to meet with guys here from Google. Actually, one of the Facebook guys were, one of the key kind of cool things I took from it was the Facebooker said that they give a /64 per host in their data center. And the reason why is they're saying that they don't want to have any more port conflicts. So they say that if you have a service running on your host, like a web service, rather than competing for ports and connection, give it an IP address. There, you have a new IP address, and that's... So they're actually working on with the IETF on having, like, basically an IP addressed services. As opposed, so you would have, if you have HTTP, you would have a certain address. If you have NTP and have a different address on the same host if it's listed, rather than trying to compete or have port collision issues. So that was kind of an interesting kind of paradigm, which obviously IPv6 offers that IPv4 you would never even dream of thinking of it because it's not possible. But obviously with the scale and the numbers, in fact, with IPv6 it is possible, and that's what they were using. And it was interesting, obviously they were doing it on a scale that was significantly larger than, let's say, a lot of the WISPs. But it was just the approach was kind of interesting. You know, and then there was a couple of some of our bigger players, like, you know, Google were kind of nodding when, you know, you can see the Google engineers nodding when Facebook were saying an IP address per service and all that type of stuff with the automation. And one of the interesting things to was the lack of correlation tools that they have between IPv4 and IPv6. So they use DNS. People were talking about, oh yeah, they try to embed IPv4 addresses in the IPv6 address so that you can correlate, you know, and then the different nomenclature. So some of the Irish lads said, we actually use the hexadecimal address for the IPv4 address as the embedding, while other people were actually using decimal notation, which is obviously, when you put that into an IPv6 address, it's not actually the same address. You know, it's not a number comparison, it's a digit comparison, you know. So it was just kind of interesting. But then when I was asking lads, like, how do you keep your IPv4 security policy, your IPv6 security policy consistent? No one really had an answer. They just said, we just try to, you know, people know that when you're on board the service of V4, you have to do it for V6. And it's kind of, there's no formal tool allowing them to do it. It's kind of like their processes to it, you know, that kind of way, which is was kind of interesting, that whilst this like flagging of disparity, actually that was one of the buzzwords he used, was feature parity versus functional parity, you know, that he says they all have the same features, but do they have the same functions? And one of the cool things Ed Morley suggested was that, you know, make sure when you're getting your V6 routes, so this is for all the ISPs out there, if you're thinking of going V6, don't pull your V6 routes in over IPv4 BGP sessions. Establish a separate V6 BGP session, pull your V6 routes that way. And he says so that you have effectively two stacks that are completely independent of each other, and are not interdependent. Like, oh, I have a problem with my V4, therefore I have a problem with my V6. He says, don't make them interdependent. Have them run as true dual stack. He was saying that that's pretty much considered an established best practice. But it was nice to kind of hear a guy who's probably done thousands of networks, you know, just talk about that issue. So it was really interesting. It was just interesting to see how all the different like tunnel brokers and how they're going to switch them off. And one of the tunnel brokers that HENET was operating was up 15 years, you know, had a few hundred tunnels, peaked still at about 100 megs throughput. And they're saying that they're trying to wean people off them, that they say that their providers at this stage should support IPv6 natively. But it's kind of awesome that, like, I was actually seeing a box that was like, uptime 15 years. You're going, wow, that's that is kind of off the charts, you know.
That's crazy. So, a quick question. If you're running a pure V6 network and you want to get to a V4 resource, right, a V6 header doesn't have the capability to put an IPv4 address, right, for your destination. So, you've got to do some kind of magic in there, right? So one option is dual stack, and you talked about that, right, where you're running V6 and V4. But if you wanted to stay pure V6, I did a little look, and you could do, theoretically, NAT64 and DNS64. Have you guys ever used that, ever talked to anybody that's used it? I mean, is that like an actual thing that is pretty commonplace, or is it just something that was invented and, yeah, it sort of worked for a little while and then was depreciated? So I honestly don't know.
From what I know, it's everybody should be running dual stack natively. It's the solution with the least problems.
Okay.
Yeah, but most of what I've heard of has been people running NAT 444 or carrier grade NAT, where they can't get V4 space. They just, I forget what the space is. It's a /10, and then you just map, you know, IPs to port ranges.
So you still have to have NATing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It still requires you to have V4, some V4 addresses from your provider or a small grouping of them, as opposed to having no V4 at all.
Yeah. I was sitting around the. We were musing, Lucas and I, my engineer, and we were saying, you know, so if you wanted to actually get to a V4 resource in your native V6, how would you do that? And so we just kind of talked out, you would have to have like a DNS server that would see a V4 response only, and then it'll make, you know, kind of a magic response on that V4 and wrap it in some V6, and then send that to the client, and the client would go, and you would have to see that, and then NAT it, and sure enough, yeah, it's an actual thing. It's NAT64 and DNS64. I just, you know, the fact that it exists doesn't necessarily mean people use it. I was just curious how
I think it's goes one about it. Prevalent technologies for transition that they are actually using. Like, there was a lot of other ones that they were trying to do before, like, attempts of having, like, I think at one stage they tried to do it like where, oh, you'd have an address and it would be embedded, the IPv4 address would be embedded in a certain, and then that would be interpreted that it needed to go to the V4 internet and stuff like that. But effectively, like, you're talking about massive connection tracking and all that type of stuff and all the problems. The transition technologies have the same problems as carrier grade that. That said, just to point out that the ripe allocation policy of keeping the final /8 with 1,000 addresses per new startup is not to give them IPv4, like 1,000 addresses. It was actually to give them a foothold on the internet, to allow them to use transition technologies, a small bit of IPv4 to communicate with the legacy internet, but effectively roll out IPv6 in a more comprehensive way. But even like some of the scope of what they were talking about was like for machine technology, you know, where like manufacturers want to have multiple sensors in a car and actually reading them all simultaneously and having them all actually individually routable without any NAT back to, you know, via satellite back to the control center. This, particularly with more complex vehicles and all that, that they were saying that obviously IPv6 enables this with a significant less hassle than they would have if you were, you know, and in certain scales, just the IPv4 just doesn't allow to do it. Even if you used, you know, your multiples of 10 addresses, it would just make it insanely complex to do it. While with IPv6, like the number of addresses we get, one of the interesting things actually I found out from the right was that everyone who gets a slash, at the moment by the default allocation for a layer is slash 32, but then what they do is when they give you a slash 32, they actually book a slash 26 for you. And so they'll actually, if you ever want to get more, you're just going to aggregate your, so you'll go from a slash 32 to a slash 31 to a slash, actually we got a slash 29. So right, the allocation you have is up to a slash 29 without any justification. So I said, 32, which is bigger? Yeah, I'll take that. It was huge.
How American of you, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was pretty much, but effectively, if I went back to them in the morning, they'd probably ask me, how did I address all the stuff? But it's bad, like, you know, giving people slash 64s for a domestic user, maybe more if you want to be generous, and then they're saying, like, 56 or a 48 for business users. It's slash 48, like, it's just fucking huge amount of addresses. Trying to see, I have a ripe kind of help card to see how many addresses it is, and somewhere here. But it was just really interesting, actually. Of course, actually, that was one of the things for the WISPs that are operating in Europe or Middle East, who are in the RIPE region. I would really recommend the RIPE courses. They have various different ones. If you're a member, they will email you when they're on, and really, just they're free. Well, they're part of your membership fee. And they're well worth the trip to go. They're very structured, the delivery is quite good, actually. So they do anything from IPv6 training to how to do root objects in the RIPE database, or, you know, and, you know, the guys in America should be mad jealous of us because we're such awesome organization coordinating our IPv4 and IPv6 space. But
Do you guys have an equivalent of Nanog over there that's as powerful? Not powerful, but large.
There's Nanog, there's Mednog, which is the Middle East. I suppose RIPE, the RIPE meetings are actually quite technical, to be fair. Like, there is a lot of burdens of a federal sessions. It does run over 4 days. They're pretty impressive, I have to say. There was one in Dublin 2 or 3 years ago. I should be going to more of them because I do think the people here, they're on a really high level. They're really good. They're on their game. And you get to talk to guys who really have been there from the start and have actually written the standards that we should be following. It's really cool. And they're very open about trying to engage the community into bringing you into the new standards, you know?
Cool. All right, guys. Well, we have hit over the hour plus mark, so I think we should stick a fork in it. Mike, if people want to reach you offline, what's the or not necessarily offline, but online? What's
offline,
the best?
You give my house's address. Is that what you're looking for?
Can you give us some GPS coordinates? No,
123 Main Street.
Yeah. If you'd like people to reach you out there on the interwebs, how would you like them to?
I would say probably the best way is probably the Bellers Bus Facebook, and then I'll coordinate something else from there. Because I've discovered that if you're not friends with somebody in Facebook and they message you, you don't ever see it until you go look for messages from people you don't know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So the Brothers of West Facebook page, that's Mike. That's virtually every bit of content that gets put up there is Mike. Occasionally the rest of us will put a little something in. So again, if you're interested in getting some immediate feedback, that's the best place to go. You're going to get it quick. Mr. Smith, if you want somebody to be able to reach you, how would you prefer them do that?
Skype, Tom Wireless Connect to you, all the words, or tom.smith with a Y at wirelessconnect.eu. Facebook, kind of on Twitter once every 2 years, so probably wouldn't use that. Facebook, email, my mobile phone, +353 87 619 3172. That works on WhatsApp.
Oh my God, can't
as well. But yeah, that's it. We welcome it. Thanks, Craig.
All right. Thomas Kernack, the guy who owns, Kernack, runs, guy, operates, develops Unimus. How would you like people to reach him?
Yeah, Facebook, YouTube, email. Whatever else we have.
What's with that interesting feedback? Echo.
Sorry?
Somebody's got their something looping. Yeah, Tom, mute. I think it's you. All right. Go to town. Sorry about that, Thomas.
Where should I... Give me the line. Give me a line. Where should I start from?
Unimus, how do we reach you if we want to contact you offline?
Yeah, just the email, LinkedIn, the Facebook, whatever. Just Google my name. Look for me. I'm fairly easy to find.
You always forget to tell people to go to Unimus. Unimus.
Yeah, Unimus.net. We are also on Facebook. Just come and visit us on Facebook forums, everything.
All right.
And that's a vendor that does something really well, and every feature is properly supported.
I don't think he's got any listed bug pages, though. So, as per Tom Smith...
No, we actually have a public tracker that lists all the bugs.
Damn it. I was trying to call you out. Sorry about that.
Mike, thanks for the phone call, by the way.
Alright.
That was Barack Obama, or who was his chief of staff that's now your mayor?
Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah.
Were you really secretly hoping for Hillary Clinton?
I tell you, I would comfort her. I was hoping to be able to high five her in the Oval Office, but
that's so inappropriate. She's so old. Let's see. If you want to reach me, gregsowell.com, gregsowell.com. There's a little contact form. That's a good way to get a hold of me. I try and get back to as many people as quickly as possible. Sometimes there's a deluge, and then sometimes there's just absolutely nothing for a little while. Reach out. Tell me your problems, and maybe we've got some solutions. If you are interested in contacting the Brothers Wisps, again, do it through the Facebook page. There's a lot of good content going like that. If you're old school and you don't like doing the Facebook thing, you can do contact@thebrotherswisp.com or contact us, whichever you like. It all goes to the same place. I guess if you have any questions or comments, please let us know. If you want to hear more of Tom, or more likely less of Tom, please let us know. No. If you have any events coming up,
which Tom now? Are you talking about the guy there?
No, that's Thomas. That's Thomas. You are Tom. You are Tom.
Sorry, Tom. I thought he was being really hard to you there. He didn't even talk that much.
No.
I would say, not talking about me, definitely. Okay, move on. Sorry.
No, you're going to see Tom Smith on some CPAP commercials pretty soon, singing their praises. It's a lifesaver, right?
Seriously, apparently I didn't have sleep for 5 years, and I had my first 3 hours sleep. It was like I took that limitless pill. It was like suddenly, and it was just 3 hours, and I was actually up at 1 a.m. because I was doing the midnight changeovers. And it was like the first 3 hours sleep I had in. I actually don't remember the last time I woke up feeling fresh. Like, it's insane. So if you do snore a lot, get help, because you will not know yourself.
Which is an understatement, because I shared a room with Tom one time, and snoring is not what he does. It's like you're bunking next to a garbage truck, I think, or possibly a jumbo jet.
It actually at that same show, that Greg bunked with Tom. I bunked with Justin. I've done it several other times, but it was like, why don't we stick the two terrible snorers in the same room, and the two guys that aren't in another? But it was halfway through the show before we got that idea.
Yeah,
but it's like seriously, like if you fall asleep really easily, like if people are talking to you while you're sitting at traffic lights.
I do that when you're talking.
Really, I'm a very engaging person. It's obviously like, but if you don't understand something, just ask. Don't get bored. Just ask. No, but like, I remember I was having a drink with Justin Miller, who's not on at the moment, but and he just when he started talking about work, it was around 11:30, but literally he started talking about work, and about 10 seconds later, I'd be just nodding off, and it was terrible. Like, it was really rude, obviously. Can you imagine? It was like I had narcolepsy. But it was just exhausted. And I have to say, my whole productivity and ability to solve problems while suffering, that I feel I'm getting my mojo back. I feel like I'll be, but we'll see.
All right. On that note,
I'm all excited.
Thank you, everybody, for watching and or listening. I'm sure most of you listen. I can't imagine why anybody would stare at our mugs, but it's there if you want to. So thanks, and we'll see you guys next time.
See ya.